Dave Fanning. Weekends on 2FM.
Now, after living in New York for many years, and at the age of 26, artist and writer Beth O'Halloran from Dublin decided to move to Japan to experience something new. That something new turned into a 3-year stay in a monastery over in Japan. So she now believes that the training that she received there has helped her deal with the current COVID restrictions, and she joins me now to tell me all about it. So welcome to the programme, Beth. What made you decide not only to move to Japan, but then to live in a monastery?
Hi, Dave. It was a little bit of a roundabout journey. I think I was living, as I said, in New York for a good while, and I had so many scrappy bits of work. My head was just like a bag of spaghetti at the end of it. And on one of my dog walks, I'd stopped by this bookshop, and ironically, I'd bumped into my own sister's book. So I have a sister, and my eldest sister was a Buddhist monk herself and had become the first Western woman to become an enlightened Zen master. So this kind of sounds like a really esoteric thing, but with my experience of her being my own sister, it just seemed like a perfectly natural thing to do. Anyway, I went into this bookshop and I was looking at her book going, oh, look at that. And then beside it was this a travel book for Japan. And I just flipped it open to this page that showed this place called Tottori. It had the longest sand dunes in the world. And I said, this just looks amazing. And I had this sort of very fantastical idea of moving to Japan, visiting where my sister had been a monk, but more just finding a little quiet. Like, I had this thing of like a shack on the beach, and I just listened to the sea and meditate and paint. Completely ludicrous idea, but I thought that might be possible. Anyway, what happened was I arrived in Japan, and my sister, who Jane, another sister who was living there and teaching English, said I could stay with her. And I ended up just staying in her place. The very day after I arrived was the Kobe earthquake, so that was kind of a bone shatterer. And a lot of things I might have learned from that experience, actually, with sort of kind of major disasters occurring and then how people can react to them in surprising ways.
Okay, well, very tragically, your sister died in a bus accident on a way to Dublin at the age of 27. So was there any part of all that you wanted to, like, go as far as she had gone, because she had gone somewhere where it just sounds so interesting to you? Like, she travelled to Japan in the early 80s and became the first Western woman to become an enlightened Zen master. I mean, obviously, in all that questions, what's an enlightened Zen master?
Yeah. I think, you know, a lot of that stuff, it just sounds so foreign and exotic. And I thought so too at the time. But I had a friend over in Japan explain it to me better than anybody. And she just said, look, the only difference between me and an enlightened master is that when they get all upset about something, they feel that upset, and then the next minute they don't. They just grant. So they just understand that stuff just swims through you, and they don't hold on to it. So there's no big mystery to it. It's like being enlightened just means basically being unshadowed by all your stuff. Yeah. You know? So I thought that was a handy one. And then to kind of understand that really, you know, I went over there having this very idealistic idea of what my sister had done as well, but then realized it's not esoteric at all. It's like you're sitting on a cushion in a beautiful place, you know, but it's no different than what you could be doing here in Dublin in COVID.
But I mean, like, what you did is you moved in with your sister and then you decided to join a monastery just like that. So, why did you decide that, and what was it like to join a monastery?
I decided that I was always really interested in the effects of mindfulness. You know, I was an artist always, and you know, when you're paying attention to something like that, sitting there drawing, I've spoken to my musician friends, certainly talk about the same thing, or my friends who knit, you know, just this kind of spaciousness that comes in when you're doing something like that. So I would have had really lovely kind of experiences while drawing, of kind of losing track of time. And just, I often think of drawing like a seismographic needle, you know, this thing that's just moving across the page, and you get to see what your state of mind is like. So I just had this idea that if I could figure out a way to live the way that I felt like when I was drawing, then that would be a key to having a happy time in life. so that was a big part of it. It was really just I had these glimpses of a much broader way of feeling, and I just wanted to live that rather than have it just be when I had a pencil in my hand.
Okay, but was it a journey to Buddhism?
Not really, because I wouldn't even call myself a proper practicing Buddhist. You know, it was more a journey to kind of peace of mind, and certainly to coming to terms with the loss of my sister. I really delayed that grief, I think, because she died in Thailand and she'd already been living away for such a long time. I don't know that I'd fully processed it. So going there and actually seeing the place that she had been, seeing how heartbroken the people were who she had lived with, that really deeply touched me. I'd never met them before. And so it was, I'm sure we're talking about that a lot now, is like what collective grief is like. Yeah. It was really...
Tell me, we're talking 3 years here, like 3 years in a monastery. So what's a typical day in the life of, in your life in the monastery?
It was highly regimented, which was nice in a way. It's kind of like being a toddler. I keep thinking of it as like, it was like Hogwarts for paying attention. So you have lots and lots of rules. So, and bells, constant bells and incense. So your day would start at like 3:20, you'd hear the first bells starting to go off. And then you just, like in a trance, you stand up, get into your flip-flops and go and sit in this big, huge hall where you get to chant. And that really wakes you up. I often didn't understand what a lot of the chants were about. It was just this great way to kind of open up your lungs by like bellowing into the night. And then as you have this all chants and drums, and you kind of do that for about an hour, and then we go into the Zendo, which is like the meditation hall, which I always found really amazing, because above the entrance to the hall, there was this carving. And on my first sort of very naive trip to the Zendo, I was like, oh, what does that mean? You know, thinking it was going to mean something like, oh, you're now entering the sanctuary of peace or something. And the monk said, it means you're now entering the tunnel of thorns. And I looked in and saw all these people, and they look so peaceful. You know, they all look like something from the Easter Island. The statues, just these really still monks sitting on, like it was like a chicken coop. We're all up on these little ledges. And I got to understand what that meant, why sitting with your own thoughts could feel like a tunnel.
Okay, it was a fantastic experience, and you really, can I say, enjoyed it?
Mm-hmm.
You did enjoy it.
I really enjoyed it, despite it being, hard.
Are there some people who thrive better in the structure of the rules than others? And I would put you possibly into the second category, but still, it was a challenge, so you did it.
I was not good with those rules at all. And there are certain people who are just more naturally organised in their way of thinking and who really liked structure and kind of thrived with it. But I was just hopeless. I think coming from an art college where, there were very few rules. And then New York, living in the East Village, that was the time I was working in Chennai. It was just like a really nice bohemian world. You know it yourself. So it just didn't fit with me to have people telling me the precision of it. I didn't understand why it was important to have my kimono exactly right, or my chopsticks at this angle, my bowls in the right place.
Hold on, I was going to ask why did you leave, but I think that's the answer, is it? After a while, it just became a little too much for you?
I think what happened, I had some really extraordinarily wonderful experiences, particularly when I got to go up and just live on my own in these, those pagodas that look like a Christmas tree. I got to go and spend different patches of time there, usually up to about 3 or 4 weeks at a stretch.
In the whole thing of a Buddhist monastery, like the practices would be like to change yourself in order to develop the qualities of awareness and kindness and wisdom, etc. And one of the things is there's no worship of a creator God. So it's not a religion in the normal Western sense. So a lot of those things, like, you have to be fully responsible for your own life to develop qualities, wisdom and compassion and all that. Do you think you got a lot of that out of it? One of the reasons you liked it all was that it wasn't, if you like, an organized, like a Western religion.
Absolutely, because there's no getting away from the fact that we've got the Catholicism thing in our veins. It's pretty hard to cut, and even that whole like idolatry thing. I did find certain things like, oh, this is a bit spooky at first, like looking at all of these different statues. So there was a kind of a resistance to anything that felt like religion. But it's really, really not like that. You understand very quickly. It's very much a philosophy. And the group that were there, they were all coming from all different traditions and no traditions. And a lot of people from the Jewish faith there. And then people who just didn't.
Well, they do say that Buddhism is something that's caught and not taught. So did you catch it?
I did. I caught the Buddhism.
And when you came back home then, returning to Dublin after spending 3 years in a monastery, what was that like?
It was a bit like I think we might be about to go through now with the re-emergence after COVID. You know, I was really scatty with time. My friends were just like, I was always late or forgetting to meet them for lunch. Mm. Time had become a big marshmallow and I kept locking myself out of my house because I kept forgetting to bring keys because I didn't need keys or money. I was kind of like a toddler again. And I was really oversensitized to sound and busy places and a lot of...
So you use that old excuse. Oh, listen, I've just spent 3 years in the Buddhist monastery. I have no money. You pay for it. Yeah, okay, great. So hold on a second then.
That whole thing. I forgot my wallet.
Let's go back to COVID restrictions then again. Like, so living in a monastery, what's that got to do with COVID restrictions? Do you think basically that the training was great practice for living in this odd 12 months?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I kept thinking there were so many things that were like it, things that we've already touched on there. It was a very hermetic world, obviously. Mm-hmm. You step back in time and you're wearing these clothes that are from medieval times, really. And, you know, with the pagoda experience in particular, there's no running water, no toilet, no electricity, no mirrors, obviously no phones. We weren't allowed to bring watches with us so that you didn't have those kind of anchors that we have normally in society and places that you have to be at certain times and ways you get to define yourself of like, oh, I am an artist or I am a teacher, which, you know, we all wear loads of different hats. But yeah, when you have all of those things stripped away, there's a different thing that happens. And at first, of course, you can feel a real crisis with it because you've gotten so used to defining yourself by what you do.
Okay, well then, if you are a teacher, and I don't want you to teach the art or whatever it is else that you're teaching, I want you to teach me something else. Because if it's a path of practice and spiritual development that leads to insight into the true nature of life, and this is what you got, what advice do you have for me? Teach me something there, teacher.
Okay. Well, one thing that I got from another teacher is this fantastic, she's a neuroscientist, actually, Jill Bolt Taylor. She's written a great book about this stuff. And she wasn't coming from a Buddhist-y thing, but it's totally the Buddhist-y thing. But basically, the idea that any difficult emotion we might experience at any point of a day, if we fully relax into it, as in, even if it's anxiety, so I know that sounds weird, but if you're feeling any difficult emotion, if you try not to resist it, to try to just think, I'm sitting here on my cushion, and here comes the depression, here comes the anxiety, here comes the mind-numbing loneliness, whatever it is, just say, okay, this only lasts 90 seconds at most. Like it's a chemical, like a whole network of things that apparently happen in our brain. But any really difficult emotion only lasts 90 seconds. So if you can, so sometimes I will just actually take out my phone and look at the timer and feel this horror shivering through me, as we've all had 50,000 times over this COVID time. And I just have a different sense of relief knowing that I have that tool, that this thing isn't going to last. I mean, I know everybody says, this too shall pass. I never really got what that meant until you think, actually, this really will pass. And if you could just get through just a few seconds and just try not to tense up around the difficult feeling or, you know, reach for your phone, which, you know, I still do 50,000 times a day.
But yeah, as everybody does, yeah.
Okay,
well, I'm going to start with that and I'll come back to you later. Listen, Beth, thank you so much for talking to us on the programme today. Beth O'Halloran back in Dublin and sounding very happy and calm. thanks a million, Beth. Good luck. Take it easy.
Thank you so much, Dave. Bye.
Bye. Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.